The microscope, for instance, reveals a new world to our eyes, a wonderful world which shows that the corpse we thought statically dead is in truth dynamically alive with active parasites, that the water we thought uninhabited simply teems with minute living creatures, that the razor edge we thought perfectly straight is saw-like and crooked, and that what is perceptible to the gross senses is only a pitifully slight abstraction of what is still imperceptible. A few centuries ago everybody glibly said that the unaided first impressions referred to facts, whereas modern science now declares that the later ones alone refer to facts. Both groups of observations seem to contradict each other, or appear to falsify each other. Yet millions of people have been thinking and many still think of the simpler observations as being facts. We still go on applying the old primitive terms to such phenomena, although every student of science now knows them to be technically inaccurate and misleading. Our minds still use concepts of the world as it is signaled by the naked senses. Our talk still embraces verbal expressions based on those delusive concepts. Language trails like a laggard far in rear of our knowledge. How can those who unguardedly use such a deceptive medium of thought, understanding and communication ever hope to bring the ultimate truth of life within their reach? For what in the last analysis is the significance of these statements? Question mark. It is that men may easily read their own beliefs into the word fact. When we consider matter scientifically, we learn that every material object is constituted of whirling electrons. Your typewriter may report itself to the senses as continuously existent and constant, but it reports itself to modern laboratory inquiry as an energy whose waves undulate away in a moment. Still more, science, having failed to find an ultimate substance, has dropped the word object for the word event, so that your machine is a complex of events in space-time which can never identically recur twice. The typewriter, as a space-time fact, can never be identical at successive moments of time. So long as your concern with the machine is merely a practical one, these considerations may not interest you, for they have no value when you want to write on a sheet. But gee, your concern is a scientific one, because you seek to learn more truth about the type of worship of words. Writer, as a material object among many others, these considerations become vitally important. It would then be erroneous and misleading if you thought of the word typewriter, that is defined it, in the same way that you would think of it from the practical standpoint. Should you stick stubbornly and slavishly to the old pre-scientific definition, it is quite obvious that you would never get at the scientific truth, but be tricked by the five senses and corrupted by the word itself. If you insist on regarding the term fact as holding only the superficial content which the ordinary man usually assigns it, that is referring to matter in its crudest sense, to whatever is tangible to the unaided five senses, you remain in an atmosphere of thought which prevents the acquisition of truth. Nor is this all. If you could wait for thousands of years and watch the process of gradual rust and eventual decay through which the typewriter would pass, it would eventually crumble away into dust and vanish from sight altogether. It would thus be transformed into some other stuff. In an altogether new form it rolled somehow continue existence. Inquiry into the nature of that ultimate existence is a work that rises beyond science into philosophy, which then reveals a previously unsuspected version of the meaning of fact to which the student will come in due course, and which is at present beyond the horizon of the specialized scientist. Philosophy is thus not satisfied with knowing the fact of a moment, it wants also to know the permanent fact, if there be one. Hence it is of little use to the philosopher to be told that something is a fact when the statement is made by someone who has never sought to know the characteristics and tests of a fact. If he wants to get effectively at ultimate truth, he has indeed to retranslate some part of the terminology of everyday life. He cannot use even such a pre-scientific term as fact indiscriminately without mutilating modern knowledge, for it is but one of a number of major words borrowed from the realm of everyday experience which carelessly used may hinder him from attaining right thinking because their meanings are too blurred by popular misusage. How much more will this be the case when he ascends beyond the scientific level into the still more rarefied atmosphere of their philosophic interpretation? Such correction of his vocabulary will lead to the correction of his thinking, because both are inseparable. Unconsidered words of this character carry a heavy burden of ancient half-understandings, primitive miscomprehensions and erroneous modes of early thought from which they ought to be purified whenever they are utilized for anything higher than rudimentary practical purposes. Release from these defects should be sought. Language is linked with knowledge and should logically evolve with it, not drag painfully behind it. Our examination of these four terms, truth, God, spiritual, fact, has revealed the contradictory definitions which each one may yield to different users. They are glibly uttered by everybody, by men in the street who have never given a day's thought to them, by many who are even incapable of giving them such thought, and, let it be said exclamation mark, by every mystic who presumes his ecstatic experiences entitle him to speak the last word concerning them. How can any of these people rightly possess certitude when he has not taken the trouble previously to ascertain what it is that corresponds to his words? But the haziness of his thoughts provides him with convenient shelter under which to take cover against troublesome questions or sudden doubts. The student cannot afford to tolerate such weakness. This examination has also shown the vital importance of obtaining a definite understanding of word thoughts which can act as a working compass to lead him out of all this confusion and give him right direction in the quest. This effort to reach semantic understanding is what the student must seek to achieve from now onwards, and he must also bring within its scope certain other important terms of a similar nature as they arise. He must guard against using words which bring emotional satisfaction but lack intellectual enlightenment. He must beware of terms that cater to ancient prejudice and ingrained habits but define nothing factual. He must recognize that to release himself from the tyranny of superficially used language is to release his mind from the burden of ignorance and misunderstanding. He must protect himself against false theories which rest not on verified fact but on fictions of purely verbal construction. It is not the purpose of the present chapter to take up all the chief ideas expressed in religious, mystic, philosophic or everyday terms and analyze them. Words like intellect, reason, reality, exist, mind and so on will appear and be defined in the course of this book, and a re-education of thinking may be effected when their meaning is properly attended to. The precise purpose here is to prepare the reader's mind by broadly showing the way to deal accurately with the verbal problems that rise, by explaining the general principle which must be followed from now on. First difficulty of the problems of philosophy is that their real nature is usually hidden from those that seek to solve them because the language terms in which these problems are stated stand at the end of a long series of known and unknown processes. Analysis helps to unearth what is implicit in them. The seeker will therefore have to apply the method of verbal discipline not only now but at every further step of his study. Hence he must here learn to pick up a special intellectual characteristic. He was told in the previous chapter to pick up certain other characteristics essential to philosophical inquiry. These two chapters are therefore quite complementary. A consequence of this effort will be that he will gradually escape from the delusion which often haunts so many religious, mystical and metaphysical people among others, that they have learnt something veridically new whereas they have actually learnt nothing but sounding words. He will discover that people explore words for ideas which they do not contain, never have contained, and never can contain, words that are often mere hollow sounds. He will come specially to beware of those indefinite meanings, those emotional words which sound so full of sense but are actually full of nonsense. Politicians, orators and demagogues particularly are fond of using grandiloquent words, slogans and phrases which either eke with gross overstatement or mean absolutely nothing relevant at all, on which are intended to arouse strong blind feelings, on which seek to cover uncomfortable facts, and do. They possess a glamorous spell, a mesmeric effect which gives a semblance of significance to them but which hides their emptiness. When he resolutely analyzes such sentences, he can destroy their false pretensions to knowledge. The use of meaningless words may lead even a reputedly intelligent man to believe that he is investigating given data and objective facts, when in reality he is merely investigating his own. hallucinations in which he may be thoroughly entangled like a fly caught in a spider's web. Most people are under the delusion that every word must necessarily represent a non-verbal thing, but there may actually be nothing at all behind its surface. The falsity of this belief that every word must needs possess a meaning is demonstrated by the possibility of using such phrases as the son of a sterile woman and flowers in the sky, which are clearly ridiculous even to a schoolboy, but are no more ridiculous to a philosopher than numerous expressions which are thoughtlessly used by people in the highest to the lowest circles. The basis of this criticism is that one ought to be silent about the truth of those things whose existence one has never verified and can never verify. To speak in such a case is to imagine, and therefore to depart from the straight road of strict fact. We ought not to permit a word to deceive us into believing that we are dealing with objects, experiences and existences when in actuality we are doing nothing of the sort. Does this word designate something real or something fictitious? Question mark should become a constant query when faced with assertions made by many advocates and most propagandists. When a word does duty for the inconceivable, it may soon blind the judgment of a man and lead him to accept the non-existent. This is pseudo interpretation, this shooting one meaningless term after another and moving in a circle which returns to the original word without having provided any real explanation of meaning during its journey. Magnificent verbal worlds are thus constructed in which their creators live happily ever after. Men everywhere entertain false opinions through their incorrigible habit of inferring that something named is something that exists, through their traditional tendency to mistake empty words for substantial realities. Hence high need to examine statements to ascertain whether they are really thinkable or whether they are merely pseudo-meanings, sets of symbols with nothing substantial in human experience that actually corresponds to them. In short, it is the need to get at what is truly known, to unveil hidden assumptions, and to elucidate what is being done when a thing is said to be true. The student of philosophy has no option but to begin by distrusting every word which does not represent a particular thing within definite and universal personal experience. He must doubt the verbal idols which former men or present tradition have set up for his worship. He must put aside the simple faith that the existence of a word necessarily signifies the existence of a thing or of an idea denominated by that word. He may then discover, to his astonishment, that its supposed existence is no existence at all. Of course, although such a word does not represent any existent object, as is supposed, it may represent a feeling of the one who utters it, and in its turn it may stimulate another feeling of the same class in the hearer. Thus he has to seek for the solid substance behind the show of language, to get at the meaning of meanings. Before he can rightly start with a sentence like, "What is the nature of the world around me?" he should ask, "What is the character of this expression nature of the world?" He has to learn how to frame questions rightly if he is to secure correct answers. 18th century chemists lost themselves in the falsity of the phlogiston theory because they asked what special substance is involved in the process of burning, instead of asking, "What kind of process is burning?" Language must be adjusted to fit the pursuit of philosophy, and not vice versa. Words which carry no meaning must be ruthlessly abandoned. Words which carry false meaning must be rigorously corrected. Words which carry ambiguous meaning must be sharply clarified. Words which pretend to represent fact but really represent imagination must be revealed for what they are. All such words hold a budding philosopher in fetters and limit the field of his inquiry until he sunders the conceptual reality of their meanings from the actual reality, the fictitious significance from the real significance. The elucidation of their ultimate meanings is a necessary stage in the elucidation of ultimate truth, because it involves the wholesale reconstruction of thought. The reorientation involved in this revision of verbal evaluations to bring them into conformity with the philosophical outlook is admittedly painful at first. It may be troublesome to become meticulously linguistically self-conscious, but the arduous effort passes into easy habit with time. Nevertheless, the half-educated frankly find it a bore, whilst the feminine sex usually find it a bother. Hence we observe few women take to philosophy and few men care for it also, unless either their mental background or yearning for truth is of the right quality. It is shy to add that the general effect of this verb and L self-training will certainly appear within the field of everyday living. As the mind becomes more exacting in its demands on thoughts and words during philosophical inquiry, so will it slowly and automatically extend the habit to include ordinary practical affairs. The universally careless condition which characterizes most thinking, permeates much wilting and distorts daily conversation will give way gradually to significant, purposeful and realistic certitude. These consequences are likely to be far-reaching indeed. Not merely the labels but the very stuff of thought will be altered and improved. When we pay attention to meaning we are paying attention to something whose range extends far beyond the sphere of communication or learning, it is carried over by its own impetus of habit into other environments and other fields of activity where we reap the consequent benefits. It is not too much to say that it leads to a mental re-education. We thus unfold a capacity for independent thinking. Words plainly force and overrule the understanding, confessed that master of words, Francis Bacon. He was shrewd enough to point out that of all the obstacles to right reasoning, those imposed by words were the most troublesome of all, and his warning to all would-be philosophers is to be ever remembered, words, like a Tartar's bow, do shoot back upon the understanding and mightily entangle and pervert the judgment. If the structure of language is after all but a system of implication, the possibilities of error and uncertainty are very real. Statements which imperfectly represent a thing may always lead to incorrect thought upon it. As before in this book, it is necessary to utter another warning. There should be no misunderstanding of the function of linguistic analysis. It is not meant that speech should exist only for the purpose of conveying facts. It is not meant that all metaphorical language, all the beauties of poetry, all the pleasures of fiction, all the relaxations of humor and all imaginative work should be neither expressed nor appreciated. The light and often grossly exaggerated touches which humor gives to conversation, the colorful patches which the reading of novels gives to leisure, are not to be rejected in disdain. There is nothing said here against such reasonable enjoyments of life. Be a philosopher, counseled Scott Hume, but amidst all your philosophy be still a man. What is really meant is that, whether talking or appreciating humorous nonsense, one ought not to be oblivious of the fact that it is nonsense, that when writing or reading fanciful unrealities one ought to know just what one is doing and not fall into the belief that there is any substance to these fancies, and that amid all the petty talk inseparable from social life one is not carried away into unconsciousness of its pettiness or into confusion of the practical with the philosophical necessities. What we require for everyday life is not necessarily to be judged by the standards of what we require for philosophical research. We may indulge in as much nonsense as we please in connection with the former within the limits of personal taste, but we may not indulge in the slightest nonsense in connection with the latter. We may utter a million meaningless words during the gossip of a lifetime without doing much or any harm to ourselves, but we may not utter or think a single meaningless word during the philosophical quest without losing our right direction. We may load our sentences with as much artistic imaginativeness or emotional color as we wish, so long as we do not deceive ourselves thereby and can acknowledge what has been done. We may peruse page after page of fiction so long as we understand the unphilosophical nature of the language we are dealing with. We may even harangue a political audience with misleading metaphors and figurative innuendos if that be our lot. But we ought not to fall into the errors which we prepare for others. Language need not be drained of coloring and fancy, provided we retain the consciousness that it is coloring and fancy. Art is as admissible into the philosopher's life as into the empiricist's. We may enjoy all these to the full, only let us not set them up as the standards whereby truth also is to be judged, and let us keep them in consciousness outside the purlieus of our keen quest for what is ultimately real. We must renounce them to ascend the altitudes like a cold ascetic renouncing the world, but we may pick them up again calmly the moment the mind turns from this study. Thus a twofold viewpoint will gradually develop, the practical and the philosophic. Such a duality will last as long as man is a seeker, but to the sage who has attained the hidden goal, all life becomes a sublime unity and there is nothing for him to guard against. What is it that the mind does when it searches for a meaning? This question provides a philosophic task of the first magnitude, and its answer is itself a mental triumph. This chapter may be summed up by the statement that when a man speaks or writes, he reveals not only what he does know but also and unconsciously what he does not know. His ignorance, no less than his knowledge, lies naked in his sentences to the philosophic insight. They constitute a document of self-revelation, a manifestation of his subconscious no less than of his conscious mind. Only the sage can ever achieve an exact formulation of his knowledge, where others reveal the poverty of their thinking by their use of ambiguous, biased, inexact or empty linguistic constructions, for he alone has burrowed to the roots of his own ideas. Thus too only the sage can detect from the style of man's speech, the character of his linguistic structures, the precise stage on the road to truth to which his intelligence and his knowledge have advanced. Philosophical analysis in linguistic matters along the lines indicated here will help the student to see whether any statement which he or others may make conveys genuine information or mere misinformation. For the philosophy of truth is taught in a particular and peculiar way. It begins to lead men to truth by pointing out their error, by showing where they think or talk nonsense, by causing them to unlearn illusory knowledge, and then by reminding them that penetration to a deeper level of inquiry is possible and desirable. It is established in the mind of its students not so much by the affirmation of what is as by the elimination of what is not. It displays the leading principles of all other known views of existence and then proceeds to show their falsity and mistakes. When these false views are once thrown out of the mind, they carry away with them numerous problems, pseudo-problems and tormenting questions. Chapter 7 The Arbitrament of Thinking Power /TTJ as a further and finally satisfactory source of obtaining /A, knowledge available. Such was the question asked in the first chapter of this book after a brief reference to religious faith. Logical thought and mystic experience characterized them all as partial, insufficient and devoid of absolute certainty. The subsequent chapters have supplied further facts for this conclusion. An analysis must now be conducted and an answer found, if possible, to the question which heads this paragraph. It should not be thought, however, that faith, intuition, logical thinking and mystic trance are valueless. On the contrary, they have their proper places and particular uses, but they should be regarded only as steps. They are not and can never be perfect instruments for the service of a man who is seeking nothing less than complete certitude. Had they really been such, then the world would have answered its age-old queries long ago and its long-drawn quest would today be unnecessary. The mere presence of many conflicting views which still puzzle mankind alone proves the insufficiency and indecisiveness of such sources, upon which mankind has chiefly relied in the past. The weary inquirer may well be provoked into asking whether the human mind is at all capable of solving ultimate problems. This is an important question. It is indeed the same as our preliminary one, but in another form. Its answer involves the answer to other questions, such as how do I get knowledge? What is meant by knowledge? Which kind of knowledge is true? All of which must be dealt with by the philosopher if he is to walk warily in the light and not dubiously in darkness. All inquiry into the final meaning of experience and the mystery of the world would be a waste of time if the very limits of such inquiry were set for us beforehand by hard impassable barriers that encircled the available means of knowledge. It is therefore better to know the worst, if worst there be, than to indulge in the folly of pursuing an unattainable quest. It is to the honor of Immanuel Kant that he was the first Western thinker to raise the question whether man possessed a mental instrument fit for knowing truth. He came to a negative conclusion. Fortunately, we need not be so pessimistic, for we shall find, as the ancient Indian sages found, that only the best awaits us in the end and that the riddle of life can be solved with man's present resources. An infant is too helpless to find its way about life alone. It has perforce to rely on others, that is its parents. So two grown men who feel more or less ignorant and uncertain about the interpretation of existence in general have to seek the help of others. Thus to satisfy such a need arises the earliest guidance offered to man, which is that of authority, whether religious, political, cultural or otherwise, and whether traditional or not. It says, "Believe and you will be safe." We must therefore begin an examination of such authoritarianism with the startling postulate of universal ignorance. And this means that the teeming masses are still infantile in some ways. Millions and millions of grown-up men and adult women living in the world today are still intellectual children who fully accept and completely believe much that is nonsensical and more that is false. We ought not to be afraid of such a statement. In the operations of arithmetic we find that the figure of 1,000,000 multiplied by naught still remains equal to zero. In human life the same calculation evaluates the knowledge of most people. But society being what it is, the masses of mankind, busy with toil or suffering in trouble, must trust in authoritarianism and in normal times can usually find no better guides through the maze of life problems than their traditional ones, provided the trust is not abused. Take the instance of religion. A religion has to establish its authority by congealing its views into formal assertions and fixed dogmas. It has to announce these doctrines as supernaturally revealed sacred truths, not as arguable human ones. The moment it is willing to discuss its tenets on any other basis than that of given and infallible revelation, it has opened a door to numerous schisms and to slow but sure weakening of its entire position. Continuance of such weakening will one day lead to its collapse. Therefore, religion prudently offers its knowledge to man as something received from a higher source, from a higher being or a higher world, which he must piously accept on unquestioning faith and reverently maintain as an unquestioned tradition. Let us examine this position. It is historically satisfactory to the masses, who naturally set out in life with the simplest possible conceptions and who are willing to accept the universe in which they find themselves without troubling their heads overmuch about it. Its value is little, however, to the few who are engaged in the quest of ultimate certitude and who are therefore counseled to begin with the exercise of agnostic inquiry. Why have the sages enjoined such a cautious attitude? Because, after all, every famous scripture is nothing more than a book which some man or men once wrote, or else it could not have come into being, and because religious beliefs flourish in such an immense variety of bewildering contradictions. Whoever ventures to inquire impartially into all of them will arrive at the end in inescapable confusion. He will be totally unable to resolve the mass of conflicting claims into any kind of unity. He can never know for certain which of the worshipped gods really exist, on which of the cosmological stories are correct, or how to harmonize either irreconcilable dogmas or the different accounts of heaven and hell. He cannot even peer into the mind of another man who is standing before him, because mind is the sole characteristic which is never normally open to public inspection. How then can he peer into the mind of a totally invisible being, God, and assert that the latter is all-merciful? For aught he can tell, God might be all-merciless. Knowledge of what is going on in God's mind must necessarily be confined to God himself. If he attempts to read the mind of God, he can only succeed in reading the mind of his own idea of God, that is his own imagination. His belief concerning God is in the end his imagination about God, it is certainly not verified knowledge. And when he perceives the hand of divine intervention in his own or others' lives, his perception is really but an imaginative effort on his part. Such an effort may fully satisfy his personal feelings and bring him much solace, but will not be better than any other imagination as a criterion of what is true. In short, his mind can come to complete rest in any religion only because it is incapable of investigating deeply or tired of acute thinking, not because it has found truth. Faith has often been shown in this world by the record of national history and the test of individual experience to be unreliable, hence it cannot lead to uniformly certain knowledge. It will be asked, perhaps in horror, then do the sages teach atheism? The charge can neither be admitted nor denied. They teach it where dubious gods are concerned, that is imagined gods. They deny it where the true God is concerned, that is God as he really is. but they do not dogmatize about the latter. What God is must constitute part of the object of our search and can only be ascertained after such search. It is a riddle to be solved, not a dogma to be set up.